UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, Mr. Anderson. I am your host, Brandon Shea Smith. Joining me, as always, to discuss movies, remakes, and sequels is Zach Smith.
Me. Me too.
Me. Me. Me and you. We are here to discuss The Matrix Reloaded. How's that? Does I sound like Walter Cronkite there?
I hope
like
you don't keep up that horrible Hugo Weaving impression this entire conversation.
Horrible? Oh my goodness, this is too... You tell me I have a mediocre introduction on our Fury Road, and now you're telling me I got a terrible Hugo Weaving.
Mediocre!
I'm just going to cry. So... Anywho, you know what? I was thinking about this, and I should have said this last time when we were on The Matrix discussing it, and you're like, oh, I always knew that they should have called it Resurrections and whatnot. You know, that's nonsense. You know what they should have called it? It should have been Matrix Rebooted.
Oh, the fourth one?
Yeah.
Why do you want to perpetuate the misunderstanding of pop culture today where a sequel is a reboot? Like, hey... Did you hear about the new Star Trek reboot? They're making a third one. It's like, no, that's a sequel. Like, did you hear about the X-Files reboot? They're coming back for a 10th season. That's a sequel. That is not a reboot. Like, whenever you hear sequels coming out, they're like, hey, they're rebooting so-and-so. Like, no, that is a continuation. That is a sequel. So, no, the Matrix Rebooted would be an incorrect title.
I don't know.
But you know what I mean, though, right? Whenever you read a story like, hey, they're making a reboot, John Wick 4. Like, yeah. No. It's a sequel. Don't know.
Well, I haven't read that article. I haven't heard them call it, like, the third Star Trek movie a reboot or whatever. No. But a reboot is a computer term, which is what The Matrix is. So, I don't know.
Which is why Reloaded is such a great title for its sequel.
Yes, I agree.
Or The Matrix 2.0.
Could have been.
Or The Matrix Legacy. Matrix Legacy is what they should have done. They could have CGI Keanu Reeves.
I don't know what it is with these R ones and why they got to do even with the fourth one have an R title. What's up with this? Why do you think they got to keep that up?
Well, Resurrections, as I said, is the perfect title for that. So it kind of continues on from the R words, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Reloaded makes sense. Revolutions... And that's a movie that people, we'll talk about it next time, obviously, but that's a movie that people call Revolution all the time. Like, yeah. It's one of those, like, you drop the S, you don't know. And I guess that didn't really, that just, to me, that's the lazier R title.
Okay.
Like, oh, well, Reloaded, what do we call the next one? Revolution, I guess? Sure, fine. Yeah. Resurrections makes sense for the story, so.
I don't know. I still think Rebooted, because they are kind of rebooting it in that it's, like, for a modern time.
Or is it? So, is it going to be the 1990s in there?
You know, so we're going to be talking about some of that in this episode, because I got some questions on some of the stuff that happened in this film here.
Okay. All right.
So, but before we do that, why don't we jump into some trivia?
Let's do it. So The Matrix Reloaded takes place 6 months after The Matrix in story. And incidentally, speaking of 6 months, The Matrix Reloaded was released 6 months before... The Matrix Revolutions, which took place immediately afterward. So you could say something for that. Revolutions and Reloaded were shot back-to-back, and the original plan was to release Reloaded and then release Revolutions just a few weeks after, not months. But they changed their mind about that, which I think was the right call.
Oh, wow. A few weeks?
Yeah. It's like they were talking about when they were going to film Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends at the same mm-hmm. time. They're like, we'll release it the same month. I'm like, that's crazy, Doc. That's eating your own audience, killing anticipation. It's a bad idea, and I'm glad they decided against that for both these franchises. And pre-production on the films lasted for a year, and then it took them a year to shoot both films, and then both films spent a year in post-production. So that is the production timeline of the Matrix sequels in the grand tradition of Back to the Future. They filmed their sequels back-to-back. So, and Pirates of the Caribbean, which was slightly after this. So,
the second and third, or later?
Yes, the first Pirates of the Caribbean came out, I believe, in 03, the same year these came out, that summer. Okay. And then Pirates 2 and 3, let's see, Dead Man's Chest and At World's End were filmed back-to-back as well. So that was all the rage. Oh. You say it makes financial sense to do that. But there you have it. We'll talk about you. We want to talk about the Pirates of the Caribbean movies one day?
Okay.
If you want.
Yeah, sure. We don't have I got to. Them all. I don't know. I don't think they're great.
I love the first one. See, here's the deal. Maybe I love them all too, right? Maybe I say this about all these franchises. I'm like, they just should have made one. And then I start watching the sequels again. I'm like, I don't know. Not so bad. We'll talk about it this time. Now, the Wachowskis' contract for doing the Reloaded and Revolutions included a stipulation that they would not have to do any media interviews. So that is why they were out of sight. And for the production of these films and all the press junkets and all that, you know, you usually see directors, writers out there, and they chose not to, not to, they actually insisted in their contracts. So there you have it. Now, Agent Smith, obviously he's in it a lot. Hugo Weaving, copying himself everywhere. Now, a lot of those, in fact, many of them, Agent Smiths, they were created by having an open casting call for men with similar body shapes and structures. And what they did was they just did face replacement on them with Hugo Weaving's face. So sometimes it is kind of duplicated, but other times it is just a face replacement for Hugo Weaving. Something that was cool. And I think, you know, there are a lot of effects that maybe don't hold up as well in this, but I do think the multiple Agent Smiths, you know, overall, the multiple Agent Smiths, I think, do. It's just especially in the what's been known as the Burly Brawl scene where he fights Neo for the first time with all the duplicates. When they switch to total CGI, it's like, is this a PlayStation cutscene? Like, you know. But outside of that, I think they did a pretty good job with the multiple Agent Smiths. So,
yeah, I think they did too. But yeah, there's some pretty sketchy special effects in this film.
Yeah. Now, Harry Lennix, who plays the general here, our commander or captain. Actually, he's a commander. He's the commander of the fleet of the human resistance. He's the John Connor, I guess, of this. And actually, he's the Michael Ironside from Terminator Salvation because he doesn't believe in the prophecy or in this stuff. He's just a hardcore military guy. He thinks it's all BS. So he's in this, as is Lawrence Fishburne, obviously, turning as Morpheus, and they both appeared in the DCEU together in Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman. They didn't have any scenes there, but I was like, oh yeah, that's cool. They got reunited from the Matrix. So anyway, there's some DC Comics trivia for y'all. Now, the role of Seraph, who is the Oracle's bodyguard, was specifically written for Jet Li. But reportedly, Jet Li asked for the same amount of money that Keanu Reeves was getting. So they were like, no. And then they changed it to be a female role and offered it to Michelle Yeoh. But she turned it down due to scheduling conflicts. So there you go. That would be cool. See Michelle Yeoh in The Matrix.
Yeah.
Now, Lambert Wilson, who plays the Merovingian, his accent is intentionally exaggerated. That's what the Wachowskis wanted him to do. He speaks English very well and said that this is he overdid the Frenchness per their request. So he is the most Frenchiest Frenchman ever, right?
Yes, he sounds like Jean Chrétien, our Canadian Prime Minister from a few terms ago.
Causality. It's like wiping your ass with silk, as he describes. Cursing in French. So I thought that was a good
line.
That
is a good line. That's a very good line, yes.
Now, Jada Pinkett Smith is in the sequels as Niobe, and she had auditioned for Trinity, as we talked about in the last discussion, and she was actually 9 months pregnant when she received the call from her agent that she was being considered for the part of Niobe in these films. So, plays a big role in this and in Enter the Matrix, which we'll talk about a little bit as we wrap up the trivia with her.
So was that Jaden Smith that she was pregnant with?
I would assume so.
Yeah.
They have a couple of kids, but...
Oh, they have a couple? Okay, that's, I guess just one movie star kid.
Jaden Smith, who is basically a CGI clone of young Will Smith. Like, if they just... I haven't seen Gemini Man, which is that movie where Will Smith meets an older Will Smith. Had they just waited a few more years, his son just could have played him, you know? Because as you're saying, After Earth, I'm like, what are they, just CGI Will Smith as a younger person? I mean, it really does look like a young Will Smith. So anyway.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Yes, that was right before M. Night Shyamalan pulled his career up from the nosedive. Like, that was the ultimate, you know, like, studio sellout bad blockbuster for him. Put him back to his roots. Anyway, Sean Connery was initially chosen to play the architect, but he turned it down because he couldn't understand the concept of the movie. So that is why they cast someone who could look like Sean Connery as the architect. Now, I think that's for the best. I would have found that extremely distracting if he just shows up and it's Sean Connery. He's like, "Oh, Neo, I'm the architect." Like, that would have been very... Like, I would have been so like, it's Sean Connery.
Yeah,
you know, and that would have just completely removed me from the reality of the film. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was already pulled out of the reality of this film because I'm like, hey, it's Admiral Dougherty. So, like...
Send your ships.
Send your ships. But, you know, what's funny is, like... So
they
I watched
have a scene about talking about ships and sending...
And I'm like, just do that S. Hold that S a little longer, buddy, okay?
We want two ships to go. Admiral Dougherty. Which came out with... That's so funny because... Insurrection was like 98, so this is like 5 years actually is a long time, but to me it all felt like, man, he was just in Star Trek.
Yeah,
like Admiral Dottery. So anyway, so but for some reason they kept the Colonel Sanders look for architect, which was,
yeah, the god look, I guess. So, but I watched the in-movie experience for this here today, and that guy's talking about he's like, I don't understand what this scene is, I don't understand what's going on here. But he's like, I'm like, oh, I could just pull out my cheap Orson Welles imitation and get paid for it. Sure, I can do that.
Okay, so, I can see the Orson Welles.
I can totally see that. Yeah,
yeah. What the man? They were really locked into like the '50s. It's like Walter Cronkite, Agent Smith, Orson Welles, architect. So, but it's like, you know, he says so much nonsensical lines. But it's like Star Trek, where, like, you know, Patrick Stewart's like, I don't know what I was talking about. I used to write the terms on my fingers so I could look down and see what the words were. So, but that's his role. Technobabble. Right, is the architect. But
an interesting thing that I learned about that room in the in-movie experience is that we saw this room in the first Matrix.
Yeah, it's the same TV screens.
When Neo is in the prison, like when he's being interviewed.
Well, he's being interrogated, yeah.
Interrogated? I didn't know that. I'm like, wow, that blew my mind when I cut that out of the
movie. So that was a
point
of view shot from the architect watching those events, clearly.
Isn't that nuts?
It was all planned out, y'all.
It's like all connected.
Now, if they couldn't get Sean Connery, Brandon, they should have got Lawrence Luckinbill, I think, for the architect. I think that would have been the... It's the guy who played Cyborg in Star Trek 5.
Oh, yes. That's funny. Sure.
Oh, man.
Or they
could
have had
well.
Admiral Dougherty for that role, too. So
Admiral Dougherty could have totally worked. It's like they just cast the same guy. I bet he auditioned. The guy they ended up casting for Architect, I bet he auditioned for Admiral Dougherty's role. And they were like, well, we got this part for you. So anyway.
For those that don't know the Star Trek movies, Admiral Dougherty is the counselor or whatever that he goes
he's
to
the,
see
He's
Neo.
The bad admiral from Insurrection. Yeah, he's
the bad admiral from Insurrection. But he's like, Neo, let's go look at the engineering room in the basement.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. People that...
Yes. The people that don't know what we're talking about.
He's the council member that and actually, really, I really like that scene, but we'll talk about it. But anyway. Yeah. Okay, so getting a little more serious now as far as the acting trivia goes. Gloria Foster, who played the Oracle, died before the end of shooting the second film. And she had done most of her scenes, but no scenes for the third film. So she was recast with an actress called Mary Alice, who was chosen as a replacement. And we see her in Enter the Matrix and The Matrix Revolutions.
Ooh. I didn't rewatch the Enter the Matrix stuff. Am I a bad person?
I didn't either. It's fine.
Yeah, okay, good.
Enter the Matrix, Animatrix. There's so many. We'll talk about that.
Well, I am going to watch the Animatrix. As I said last time, I'm going to watch it now because I have never seen them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eva Mendes, Samantha Mumba, Brandi Norwood, and Tatiana Ali were all rumored to be replacement actresses for the character of Z because Aaliyah died in a plane crash in 2001. She was initially cast as Z, but the part eventually went to Nona Gay, who was the daughter of Motown legend Marvin Gay. So she is Link's wife, who is the sister of Tank and Dozer from the first film.
Yes. So now, she's the wife of Michael. So is she the mother of Walt?
What? is that a Lost?
Yes.
Reference? Okay.
Lost
all right.
Reference. Did you never see Lost?
Disney? Okay. No, I watched the first episode, and that everyone liked it so much. So I was like, I can't be a part of this. It's too popular. It's too mainstream for me, Brandon. Now I totally forgot that Gina Torres was in this. She from Firefly, Serenity, lots of other stuff. Now she and Lawrence Fishburne were married at the time, so perhaps that's where that connection came from. But she plays the mother of Dozer's kids, Dozer's wife, Dozer's widow. So, and I'm like, wait, Dozer, Tank, they were the brothers. Which one? Didn't one of them not die? Let's talk about that. So, Marcus Chong, the actor, was supposed to return as Tank, but he had a falling out with the Wachowskis, and his part was written out, and his character was killed off screen. So apparently he wasn't asked back. The official story is he was not asked back because they had salary negotiations that didn't turn out well. He wanted $1 million to do both sequels, but they offered him $250,000. So now he, the actor Marcus Chong, sued for not honoring a verbal promise and a written contract he had for the sequels. And then he claimed the Wachowskis tried to slander him with intentionally false statements, and thus he got blackballed in Hollywood. Now, the studio came back and said that Chong had been arrested for making threats at the Wachowskis following the failed salary negotiations. And apparently, and I haven't seen this, but Marcus Chong made a documentary called The Marcus Chong Story. It's on YouTube, in which he made further accusations about this whole situation. So I haven't seen that. I can't recommend it or not because I really don't know what's in it. But apparently it's a very just contentious story.
Jeez.
Why Tank did not return for the sequels. And it's too bad because, you know, you look like the entire crew of the Nebuchadnezzar got killed. Mm-hmm. And he was the one survivor. And now we had to, like, make another character. So it kind of, like, remove some of that connective tissue to the first film when you have this new character, Link, who I did like, the new Link character. It fits that he's new, and the whole, like, conversation with him and Morpheus, like, I know you were new on this ship, but you must trust me. Like, okay. I'm like, okay, okay. But still, it kind of felt like, what are we doing here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kid, Annika was like, did they both die? And I'm like, well, I thought not, but that makes sense now. I'll talk to her about that. Because I watched this with my kids, Annika and Aubrey, and my wife, Marcy, right? And I'm like, yeah, I thought one of them survived. So, yeah, that's kind of weird. But
I guess he died from his injuries, Brandon, between the films. We'll just go with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting thing about Gina Torres as well. She was in Hannibal, the TV show, as Lawrence Fishburne character's wife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, you know, she's in this and then that. So, and she's real-life wife. You know, so,
That's cool. No, I love her from Firefly more most of anything. So I had completely forgotten that she was in the Matrix sequels. So, the martial arts training for all the actors, they started in November of 2000, and they lasted 8 months to get them ready for these films. Despite that, though, there were several injuries during the making of Reloaded. Carrie Ann Moss broke her leg training for a wire stunt. Lawrence Fishburne fractured an arm in another training incident. And Hugo Weaving put out a disc in his neck while being pulled back on a wire. So it was. But they're doing so many stunts. It's not surprising. With all the training and all the stunts they actually had to do, which is, man, these Matrix movies are full of stunts. But still, those are some pretty serious injuries for your lead actors. You know, not just stunt people. So I gotta watch out, y'all.
Isn't that what stunt actors are for? So your lead actors don't get injured?
It's like, clearly you guys have no problem with replacing them with CGI
characters.
You know, characters. So I don't know why.
Deep fakes, man. Come on.
But you got to respect that about the Matrix movies. Like, the actors, for most of it, they're in the thick of it, and you can tell that it's really them. So, putting in the work. Now, the fight sequence, the burly brawl as I mentioned, between Neo and Smith and all his clones. It took 27 days to shoot.
Good Lord.
and that took 9 minutes of screen time. 27 days for 9 minutes of screen time, which, you know, not bad, actually, if you actually do the math and think about how complicated that was. But it took 3.5 years of post-production work.
Jeez.
So
these Wachowskis are nuts.
Now, interestingly enough, in this scene, this is the only time in The Matrix where we see some of the production gear reflected in the character's sunglasses. We see a light in Agent Smith's face when he walks up to Neo. He's like, I don't know if you left something in me, but I'm free now, when he's walking up to him. And if you look at Hugo Weaving's sunglasses, you can see the light panel. Okay. On the right side, or camera right, on his sunglasses. And I got to say, you know, that's impressive that they have so many reflective surfaces, you know, in these movies. You know, there was the trick in the first movie where they just, like, put a coat over the camera when they get the doorknob. That's how they got over that. But, yeah, so for all those years of post-production, nobody thought, maybe we can paint out this this light in his sunglasses. But anyway. So General Motors donated 300 cars for use of the production, no doubt for the freeway scene. And then by the end of the shoot, all 300 were wrecked. So now the highway chase sequence, which is one of the most impressive things you'll see in movies, I think, it took almost 3 months to shoot. That's longer than most films like take to shoot, period. Longer than 3 months. It was filmed at the closed Alameda Naval Air Station. And then the main and east runway and part of another were partially repaved and striped as a restricted access highway. They built entrance and exit ramps to make it look authentic. And they had sound barrier walls, restricted the viewing angles, though. So it made it easier to insert a CGI skyline. So it wouldn't be obvious, you know, where they were or where they weren't. So that's been demolished now after filming was complete, but you can still, if you look at like Google satellite images, you can still kind of see the area apparently. So I think that's pretty impressive, right?
So you're telling me they couldn't shut down freeways in LA for 3 months?
No, they could not. I'm just impressed they just didn't do it like in a green room, you know, today.
Well,
they
did do some, like some of it was done in a green
room.
Right.
Well, of course, yeah, of course some of it, but I mean, like for, you can tell that like for a lot of it, it's, I think, you know, we talk about some of the dodgy special effects that maybe don't hold up still. Like, I think the problem is there's so much practical stuff for their own camera. When they switch to something that's CGI, you're like, whoa, what? Wait a minute. Like, they would have just best to leave that stuff out and just stick to, because they had so much impressive live action stuff as it was, or practical stuff as it was. But anyway.
Yeah, like when that agent jumps from the one car and smashes the other car, man, that's some pretty sketchy looking special effects.
Brandon, it's a computer program. It's fine. It's all inside a computer. It's like Tron Legacy. It's no problem. It's all inside a computer. That's why it looks fake. Nope. So now Lawrence Fishburne is actually the one who suggested that Morpheus remove his sunglasses in the fight with the agent on board the top of the truck to kind of reference back to Morpheus fighting Agent Smith in the first film, and also to show his vulnerability, right? Because you can see in his eyes and stuff like that. Now Agent Johnson actually is the kind of lead replacement agent for Agent Smith here, and he is actually returning, same actor, same character, for The Matrix Resurrections. So I'm interested to see where they go with that. And upgrades, explaining why the upgrades. Agents are still a threat to Neo, which I thought that was good. Now, the hair and makeup department went through 84 bottles of hair gel during filming this. This one, no doubt.
Hair gel.
Trinity, Neo, whoever else, right? We know Morpheus didn't need any. Lawrence Fishburne didn't use any of that hair gel, but the rest of them did, I guess. So that was a quite impressive number, I thought. But hey, apparently 97% of the materials used to make this film and film sets were recycled after they were done production. And for example, they shipped a lot of wood to Mexico to build low-income housing down there. Oh. So repurposing all the stuff. I think that's, you know, recycle, people.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Very responsible.
Yeah, absolutely. That's pretty interesting.
Now, The Matrix Reloaded promotional material was in very high demand in 2002, 2003. So the distributors were worried that people would just steal it. Like, you ship it out to a movie theater and someone's like, oh, cool, I'm going to get a Matrix Reloaded poster, right? So to counteract this, when they sent out their promotional materials, like standees and cutouts and posters, they labeled them with code names like Caddyshack 2 and The Replacements. But the problem was several cinemas thought they didn't get the Matrix materials and didn't display them until the last minute, until they finally opened these things. So it kind of... they kind of outthought themselves. Like, what a caddy... Why did Warner Brothers send us a Caddyshack 2 poster? That's ridiculous. So anyway. Now, this is the highest grossing film of the franchise, with about $740 million worldwide. It's on a budget of about $150 million. And we'll see if the Matrix Resurrections can top that. You'd think so. Today's with, well, with inflation, you never know, right? So we'll see when it all, when it's all said and done.
This was the highest grossing, so obviously it didn't.
No, Resurrections, Brandon, not Revolutions. These R titles are confusing.
Oh, jeez. I see what you're saying. Yes, never mind.
The Matrix 4.0. We'll see if it grosses more than the Matrix 2.0, okay?
I bet you it will.
Still waiting for Tron 3.0 so they can turn that R into a 3.
Yes, do it.
That's a crossover, man. I'm going to see Tron crossover the Matrix.
I'm down for
That's like RoboCop Terminator. Like, where's the comic book for Tron and the Matrix crossover? That's what I want to see. So.
As long as it's Bruce Boxleitner versus Keanu Reeves, I'm good,
yes.
Man. I'm in.
100%. What do you mean? Who's Bruce Boxleitner? I thought Jeff Bridges was Tron. Moving on, says the general audience member. So let's talk about the Animatrix and Intermatrix and all this stuff. So at the beginning of the movie, they have the meeting of the captains. They're talking about the Osiris, right? And there was a short animated film called The Final Flight of the Osiris, and it was part of the Animatrix. And it's a prequel, right? And it talks about how it's all CGI, by the way. And they show this in movie theaters, too, like before movies came out, like when you're sitting there in the theater, like it kind of showed it like as a pre-show thing and for other movies, right, to advertise this, right? You know, 2002, 2003. And the story is about how the Osiris crew managed to warn the other Zion ships about the Sentinels that are digging their way to Zion. So there you have it. Mm-hmm. And it was in that, like, kind of Final Fantasy style of CGI where, like, what? It's not quite – it didn't try to be photorealistic, and that's why it worked, you know? If it did, you get the weird results you get in some of the shots of this film. So I thought, yeah, that's cool. I recommend that to everybody. Check that out. But it's not necessary, right? To understand what's going on, you don't need that, right?
Right.
Now, Enter the Matrix, they went a step further. They just didn't have CGI. This is a video game. They actually shot footage with many of the supporting characters, like Jada Pinkett Smith, Niobe, and Monica Bellucci's Persephone, right? And there's actually a scene where Monica Bellucci's character helps Jada Pinkett Smith's character, just like in the movie, but she also has her kiss her, just like Neo kissed her in the film. So, a little risque, right, for the early 2000s, but hey, they got it in the video game, right? So, there you go.
I remember that from watching the bonus features on my HD DVD.
Did they have all the live-action stuff on there? Okay, cool.
Yeah, they did. I watched it, like, a couple years ago or whatever. But I remember it not being that good, so I'm like, I didn't really care to watch it.
I got that game, and I was like, I just was playing it to get to the cutscenes, because I was like, this game is not as fun as I might have thought it would have been.
Matthew,
I don't know. See,
he was all for this game. He had it on Xbox, and he was all over this game.
Well, I think this is where the Star Wars prequels, these early 2000s, where they really started to be like, hey, you got to watch and play everything to understand what's going on. And I don't know, like these subplots and stuff, they're cool, but I don't think you needed to see all that to kind of follow what's going on. And at least Reloaded, Revolutions, we'll see. But I think that is cool that there is so much, you know, material, like live action, like they could have easily, if they made some ultimate cut, right? If Zack Snyder directed this, they would release another version with all that footage incorporated into the movie. So, I don't know. Like, and they were playing with it. It was a new age of interconnectivity digitally and all that. So, you know, that's fine. And revisiting them, my memory goes, I'm like, why? Man, you had to do this. You had to do that just to understand what's going on. I really don't think that was the case after all. At least for this one. Second one. We'll see when we get to the third one, but...
I liked your idea there, though. You know, maybe Zack Snyder could take this and, you know, put it in black and white and 4:3, and it would be better.
Oh, I mean, yeah, that's a scientific fact. So. Yeah. Although, you want the Wachowskis to still be involved, right? But I got to say, if they stepped away, Zack Snyder would be a perfect director for a Matrix movie. So.
You're a monster. Oh, the only good Zack Snyder movie is Dawn of the Dead.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I haven't seen
it. Have you seen Legend of the Guardians, The Isles of Ga'Hoole?
No.
Check it out. Watch it with us. It's a good family film. Okay. All right, so I teased that I had some stories about Matrix Reloaded in the last episode, so I'll go ahead and start our conversation with them here. First of all, my church youth group at the time, because I'm in I'm in high school, right? So for whatever reason, they were trying to be like hip and relevant, right? As you do in a church youth group. And we had an event. This is okay, before The Matrix Reloaded came out, we had an event called The Matrix Reloaded. And it was like a scavenger hunt in downtown, and we'd like kind of run around, and like some of the staff would be dressed up like, you know, the youth staff, right? Would be dressed up like as Morpheus or Neo or whoever, leather jackets and sunglasses. It was a fun thing, right? Yeah. That was probably the summer before the movie came out. And of course the movie comes out and it has this like over the top orgy scene and all this stuff. Yeah. And it's like, perhaps we should not have tied our church youth group in with a hard R franchise. I mean, look, it's not like they took a left turn. Like, I mean, the first film was pretty chase in that sense, but still it was a rated R franchise. So it was just an illogical thing. And it makes me think of that Family Guy kind of skit where, they kind of make fun of like how a lot of youth groups try and stay hip, right? And it's like, I don't even know who's talking where, but the Griffins, the Family Guy family, like they're at something. And then some youth pastor gets up and is like, God, is that you? What are you doing here? And it's, you know, some voice of God. He's like, yes, I just got back from watching The Matrix. And I'm like, and I remember that because that's exactly what happened in my youth group when I was like, in high school. So anyway.
That's funny.
That was my leading up to it. And then seeing it,
There's a lot of nipple through the shirts in that scene.
I mean, there is. That's the weakest part of the film to me. We'll get into it. But and then this is the first midnight screening I ever went to.
Okay.
And I had to sneak in with my friend's college ID because I was 16. I was 1 year too young to see this in 2003 without my parents. So they just kind of looked at it and they let me in. And that was an event though, man. Like people were dressed up. It was awesome. Like I was like, man, I'm on the cutting edge of something here. This is our generation Star Wars. And I don't know, it felt like, yeah, man, I got in. It was very exciting.
My first midnight showing was Phantom Menace.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Did you have to sneak in?
No, I was 18. So I was 18. I was all ready for that hard R Star Wars prequel.
But yeah, so I have fond memories of the lead up to this, and then seeing it for the first time, and we're gonna suss it out here over these next few discussions, Brandon. I guess not to bury the lead, but I guess Revolutions is the one where everything gets screwed up because I actually really enjoyed Matrix Reloaded this time around. Okay. So
there we go, right on. Excellent. That's a lot of trivia. You know what, Zach? I think we need to take a little break here and just calm down. So let's cue the rave. We're back from the rave here. That was a nice little break that we had there. So I feel rejuvenated.
Shake these walls of rock, stone, and steel.
That's the weirdest freaking scene in this movie, man.
It is so strange. It is, right? It's so bizarre, right?
Yeah. I'm watching this movie, and I'm like, the first part of this movie, like, leading up to that, I'm like, this movie, like, rewatching it now, it's been a while since I've seen it, I'm like, this movie is not good. What is happening here? And then the rave scene happens again, and I'm like, oh, man, I remember this. This is really bad. This is really, really bad. I don't get it. I don't believe it. This is just nonsense. So,
well, it is odd. I liked Morpheus in this, right? Because in my memory, I was like, you know what? He kind of falls out of importance in the sequels, right? The third one, because he's like not in the Matrix. He's in all this Zion drama, right? But this one, he is a huge component. And I like seeing him as this, you could see like the cult of Morpheus or whatever, right? Because he's like, I bring you Morpheus. And everyone's like, yeah, Morpheus, right? But it's so strange because when in the first film and even this film, when he's in the Matrix, he's so quiet and underspoken and collected when he's talking to people, right? But this, he's like just like everybody party. it felt odd with his whole personality, right?
But even in this one too, he's quiet when he's like isn't that worth dying for?
Well, no, that's what I mean. Like, in the Matrix, like, not in the first Matrix, man.
Okay,
like,
in the
first film, The Matrix, and in the Matrix in this film. It's just when he is in Zion, he has this whole different persona, which I guess is why people are all excited about him and stuff. But it's so strange because he's so in line with who he was in the first film when he's in The Matrix. But when he's in Zion, like, him, like, everybody!
I think you're pronouncing his name wrong, though. I think it's pronounced Moses Fius.
That's right.
So we got to keep with those biblical terms in this film. It's Moses Fius.
So I think we can both. I don't know. I guess I like this more than you, but I would say, to me, all the Zion rave stuff is the worst stuff in the film.
I agree.
Yeah. Because you could take it out, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
and it's just excessive for the sake of it.
I mean. They had a 50-minute car chase. They had a 9-minute battle sequence with the Smiths, and then they had like a 80-minute rave scene. I don't understand why they had this 80-minute rave scene.
The only thing I can think of is like they wanted to show nipples. Like beyond just the rave, right? Yes, they wanted to show nipples. That's correct, but they wanted to show like the physical connection between Neo and Trinity, right? Because in the first film, like very chaste, like she kisses him at the end and resurrects him, right? So they wanted to show that passion they have together, and I guess that's what they did. And it was odd, like when they get back, right, in the elevator, he's like, let's go, kid. These two have things to get to. And the elevator doors close, and it's like they're finally alone. I'm like, what are you talking about? You've been on this ship with four people. You tell me you can't close the door of your room? You act like you just saw each other the first time in 6 months. You know what I mean?
I know. I did. I was thinking that exact same thing watching this. I'm like, why couldn't they just have sex on the ship? Like, what's going on here? Like, that's a big ship.
Right, especially since everyone's dead.
Like, there's room. I don't know. Yeah.
But I think all this kind of wraps our grounds. Do you think we should have ever seen Zion in these films?
Honestly, the Zion stuff is really my least favorite stuff. Like, I like seeing the stuff in The Matrix. But when we go to Zion, especially in this film, too, I just don't really like it. Like, you know, you had said you like the sequence where they go down to the engineering and whatnot. And I'm just like, this is all just boring. Like, I don't really care.
Well, it raises interesting questions where it's like, they're talking about, like, this movie, it has a through line, it has a theme about control and choice, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, the whole Matrix franchise does. So I really like the point where he's like, we're in control of these machines. We could just turn them off. And Admiral Daugherty's like, yeah, but if you turn them off, we're going to die. So it's kind of you're in a symbiotic relationship. Like, what is the really, not that we're serving them, but we can't just, we need them, right? Yeah. Much like the machines need humans, that's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there is something to be said. I like that examination of those themes, and that's why I like that conversation. I like how we slow down, we have these philosophical conversations as we continue out through the movie. That is something that the first film did quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And but I think seeing Zion is almost like best left as an idea, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you ever see it, you're going to be disappointed by it because like it's the last human city, but it's like a rave in a cave is what we get, right? And it's right. And then why is everyone... And it's weird because in the first film, it has these ratty clothes and all this stuff, right? And then when they're back on the ships here, they still have those sweaters and ratty clothes. But when you get to Zion, everybody has like these nice, well-cut, like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's just very strange.
What if Zion is a holodeck?
Well, okay, that's not to get ahead, but that's like the end where it's like, wait, so the twist is the real world is another level of the Matrix, right? That's what everybody was thinking.
Yeah.
After the second movie, because Neo, you know, quote unquote, uses his powers or whatever. I kind of forget how they explain that actually in the third one. So,
yeah, okay, so I definitely have questions. I don't remember the third one very well either, because I don't love these movies. I've seen them a few times and I enjoy them when I watch them, but they just don't stick to me. So I may have questions that are answered in the third that I don't know, but that's one of them. I'm like, so why does Neo have the ability to stop these Sentinels in the real world? Mm-hmm. And so you're saying that, like, so let's not, I don't know, if you don't remember either, then I guess we'll have to wait.
We're not going to spoil it because I don't remember. But the whole, like, you know, the whole conjecture after the film, before the third one came out, was everybody's like, oh, well, they talked about predecessors and he's the sixth one and all this, right? The real world is just another level of the Matrix, man, right?
Yeah,
that and that would have been like, okay, like, that's a Star Trek plot, but... That would have at least made sense, maybe?
Could have been,
and then you could have said Zion was just a simulation anyway, and we wouldn't feel like such a cheat. I don't know. But I think a lot of it is because we never saw Zion in the first one. Right? Mm. So you build up in your head what the last human city is going to be, and then we see it, and there's some interesting philosophical conversations that happen there, in my opinion. But at the same time, it was kind of a letdown just to see how just bureaucratic it was and like lame. Although I do like, I was joking about him before, but Harry Lennix, who, again, he's in the DCU movies. I like him on The Blacklist, right? TV show on NBC. He's a main character on there. I like his character where him and Morpheus come into conflict about like, hey, man, I don't care about your prophecies. Like, I'm looking just practical. Like, we got to fight this and that. There would be people who would be like, this guy's crazy. What's he talking about? We got to fight these machines the old-fashioned way. I don't care about any prophecies or something. That's a very logical conflict to have, a very, you know, reasonable way to create conflict between your characters. So,
yeah, I agree. But then there's that sequence in there where that staff, the Federation Council Chamber or whatever, is like, we're looking for volunteers to go after the ship, right? And we need two volunteers to do this. And, like, nobody steps up. So you've got this whole group of, like, just peasant people, right? Plain, normal people who are just worshiping Neo when he comes out. And they're giving him food, and they're saying, bless my child, and all this. And then, like, to have nobody in the crew of the starship, like, well, starships, whatever, you know what I mean, to be jumping up and saving him. Like, well,
you know, Brandon, you know what the name of that first guy who stood up was?
Who?
Soren.
Yeah, Soren, that's right. Yeah, I remember that Star Trek reference. But then, so the Soren guy steps up, and then nobody else wants to. And then, I don't know, maybe this is covered in the Enter the Matrix scenes and whatnot, but when Niobe stands up, and the conversation she has, it's just like, you know what? I don't want to be your girlfriend anymore, so I'm going to go back over to Morpheus and save him. And that's what that felt like to me. So it didn't even feel like she wanted to do it, because she's sitting there talking about him, and she doesn't really believe, she's talking to Morpheus and doesn't really believe that he's the savior either, right? When they're sitting there in the Matrix at mm-hmm. that table near the end.
Well, Brandon, some things never change, but some things do.
That's a nonsense one. That's a dumb. But that whole Morpheus, Locke, and Niobe thing, that's a waste of screen time. Like, I don't
Locke,
know. Like, it's
thank
just...
you. I keep forgetting his name. Commander Locke. Yeah. Locke, I just, yeah. We didn't need the love. We didn't need the love triangle. It was kind of unnecessary drama, I think, for the sake of it.
Yeah.
Like, you could have had Morpheus and Niobe had been a couple, and then he saw the Oracle and kind of went off on his calling, and they could have just been exes. But having Morpheus, commanding officer, who they have a philosophical difference with, also be the new man in his ex's life is, like, too convenient. You know, you don't need that. So I agree. So.
Yeah. But did that not feel like she's, like, when she volunteered to go, it's like, I'm breaking up with you and I don't want to be with you anymore.
Well, it seemed that way, but we don't know. Like, we needed a scene between, like, a real scene between the two of them before they left. Like, to kind of wrap that up, you know? Instead of him, like, why are you doing this? Like, for
her, yeah, I don't know.
To say what Morpheus said to her earlier. So I was like, yeah, I agree. It's the only way to read it is like, yeah, I'm gonna go back with him now. It is strange and an unnecessary subplot. I do agree. But hey, let's talk about some good stuff, right? And then we can talk about some bad stuff again, as I'm sure you have more of. But I do want to talk about Agent Smith in this movie. I feel like, I mean, he was great in the first one. I think him in this movie kind of elevates him even further as like one of the top villains in movies, just because he has this kind of self-aware sense of humor now. I love where he's like, me. We kind of joked about it, me too. More. Like, I just, it was so good. And he was like a fun guy. And it was so interesting to hear him say Neo. I think that's probably the only time he says it, because he calls him Mr. Anderson all the time. Like, when he shows up, he's like, I'm looking for Neo. It was so strange. And I think it would feel... I think it's really cool how it could have just been a lame, lazy, like, well, he was really popular in the first one, but let's bring him back. No, the fact that how Neo destroyed him in the first one, kind of, like, he explains, like, something with you mixed with me, and now he's kind of like the Antichrist, Neo's Christ, if you will. Like, there are these, you know, so that explains why he's still around and can do all these things, instead of just like, oh, well, he's back again because he's the Terminator and he has the same face. You know what I mean?
Yeah, see, I didn't get that. So I said, like, I remember him saying that, but I'm like, I wrote down here, my first note is, why is Smith back? Right? Like, I like him. He's really good. But I don't understand why he's back in this. So, that explanation doesn't work for me.
Well, I think it does, for me anyway, because if Neo was, like, the one, like, he went inside his program and blew him up, right? So, like, something got left over, and now he's his opposite. So, you know, they play into more of that in the third film.
Okay.
You know? But I like that as a justification for why he's back, and where he's not just another... Look, he's another Terminator off the assembly line with the same face. They didn't go that route. They went like, he's the same guy. He's been fundamentally changed by Neo, and he actually got what he wanted because he's free of the Matrix, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, that's pretty cool. Now let's talk about that. That's a missed opportunity, and I thought was something that was set up for something that was so cool in this film that is part of the reason why the third film is, as you know, I guess that must have been where it all fell apart, because I actually really enjoyed this one, and I'm notorious for saying the Matrix sequels aren't good. Mm-hmm. But when he takes over the guy who goes into the real world, I thought, oh, that's really cool, right? Like, that's a cool story possibility. Bane, right, is the guy's name in the real world. And mm-hmm. That's so interesting, that casting of that guy. I'm like, that guy looks like a kind of Hugo Weaving. Like,
yeah, he does, in the eyes.
It. It's something in the eye, yeah, right? Yeah, but that's such a cool idea. Like, oh, he's a program. And part of his motivation of the first film was he wanted to get out of the Matrix, right? Mm-hmm. And now he is. So I thought that was interesting, but I felt like that got... There was a lot of potential there. And then, of course, the cliffhanger of the whole movie is he's the other guy who survived the... Obviously, he's the one that set off the EMP early and crippled the fleet and all that. That's what I took from it. And that's so cool. But then they... Like, that should be your climactic battle. Like, Neo and Smith, like, in the real world and all that stuff. But it's just kind of this weird subplot in the third one, and they resolve it, you know? Yeah. I do remember that, at least. But here, it's cool... But then it goes nowhere. And I think a lot of the... And some of the thing, this is like... The third one, doing what it does, brings the second one down, because like so much here is dependent on where it goes. And from my memory, it doesn't go places that are very satisfying. But I thought that was another cool angle for to have Smith have a real-world person running around now, too.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. See, this, too, felt like a waste of screen time to me, because... Even in this one, we don't get much out of it. We get him running up to him with a knife, and then he stops because somebody shouts out his name.
That annoying kid who, when I rewatched the first one, I was like, wait, was that kid in the first one? Like, no, that's a different kid.
He's a new character. That's what my kids asked, too. Like, was he in the last movie? And we're like, no, he's not. And then he says, oh, we should go and volunteer, too. And they're like, shut up or we'll kill you. Like, okay, that's a good crew. And then... He just shows up at the end. So even there, he's only in three scenes, and like nothing happens because of it. Nothing happens. So to me, this was a waste too. Like, because I don't know. And I don't remember what happens in the third one. Okay. So you're saying it doesn't pay off very well either. So
well, they have a confrontation, but it's like, it's kind of like in the middle. Mm-hmm. Like to me, like that's your, if I would have done it right to play armchair quarterback here, it's like, they should have kept leaning into his ultimate goal is to, he is a program, but he wants to be a real person and leave the Matrix, right?
Yeah.
And that should have been like the culmination of his goal, right?
But, so then the other thing is, though, that's not him, though. That's a copy of him, right? That's out in the real world. Because, so the way that I watch this, so like, I'm all about like originals and copies and who's who. Like, I think about this stuff, right? If you have an original and you make a copy, the copy is not the original. So the original... is the guy who's going around and making more copies. He's the guy that we see.
You think the copies can't make copies?
No, the copies can make copies because we see them. We see a couple of copies trying to go after Morpheus.
Oh,
right?
That's right.
Yeah. So the copies can, but if he got out of the real world, it's not the real Smith that got out. It's a copy of Smith.
But they're all the same.
That's fair that you can look at it that way. I'm just saying that I don't look at it that way because it's not him. It's a copy of him, right? So,
oh, man.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. I mean, have you seen The Prestige?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, so yeah. That's a very interesting... You can go down. I'm not going to say anything else, but that's a very interesting thought.
Exactly.
You have with that as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, man. For whatever reason, like, I was picking up on everything this movie was putting down this time around. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the programs, though? Because I think that is something that was not addressed in the first one that kind of seemed to kind of clutter up the whole idea of the Matrix this time around, where there's, like, werewolves and vampires and that kind of thing.
Yeah, see, that's ghosts. All weird, too. Like, okay, so I don't hate this movie. I know I'm crapping all over it right now. But, I mean, that's part of why I struggled with my rating when we get to it, right? So there's a lot of really good stuff in this. But the things that don't work for me really don't work. So I don't understand this whole ghosts and werewolves thing as well. Like, where they're like, okay, so ghosts are programs that went wrong... But then it's like, I'm trying to wrap my head around what they're trying to say, because they've got this godlike guy who's created the Matrix, right? And there's all these programs within programs that have to do certain things, right? But then they've destroyed everything five times previously, right? And so there's questions that never get answered that I think are even more fascinating, such as like, okay, so how long does the Matrix last? So if they've destroyed Zion five previous times, is the Matrix always in 1999? Or does
yeah,
the Matrix...
it's the pinnacle of their civilization. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so if that's the case, so if it's 2199, so they've destroyed humanity six times in 100 years, or in 200 years? So humanity has risen and fallen six times in 200 years? That's not very efficient.
What is that, like 40 years each or something?
40 years? So it takes 40 years to get whatever they say. There's like half a million people or whatever.
Think of
right?
it this way, Brandon. Think of it this way, though. If the one, right, fulfills his destiny when he's like around 30 or 40, that makes sense. He kind of comes of age, gets his powers, you know? That cycle makes sense because it's not like humanity destroying himself. It's like the one goes to the source and goes to the door and all that. So,
but they're killing all the people in Zion. So like, I guess all the people in Zion are just
people
the people
escaped
who've escaped.
Matrix.
So it's not the 6 billion population that's within the Matrix. Stuff,
and that's
right?
why every time, that's why they don't know about the previous ones, because as far as they know, they restarted civilization from that moment. So.
Okay, that, so the, discussing that works a bit for me then, so that's
okay.
fine. But
I just thought of that
still,
myself, about
okay,
him like
but still,
his destiny, yeah, yeah.
So it takes 40 years to build Zion? That's a pretty big frickin'
dude, it's
thing.
A cave.
Well, it's no, like it's a, not a cave. There's machines and cranes, and it's down like some frickin' shaft. Like
that
some,
is a good point.
Right? Like that takes 40 years to do that.
This is why we right? never should have like, seen Zion. That's why we never just say it.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I have not deep dive in because I kind of want to watch the third one fresh. But after that, I'm going to like do a deep dive into like reading about how these timelines are supposed to work going to the fourth one. Because these are good points you're raising.
Yeah.
Because I remember some of the turn off of like, because they made it so complicated. Because the first Matrix, it seemed very clean, very simple. Like, okay, there's machines and... their people are the batteries, and we harvest them. And to keep the battery going, we make your consciousness busy with this distraction of the Matrix.
Sure.
And everything else you see in there is a program. Okay,
right,
great,
that
got
works.
It. But now it's like, okay, well, there's self-aware programs, and everybody has their own agendas. And I'm like, okay, well, now it's kind of complicated. Why are there werewolves and ghosts, and you know, people like the Oracle? Why are they helping? You know, the Keymaker. You know, I mean, obviously there would be. Like an architect kind of character, or shouldn't, because that's something the Terminator films deal with too. It's like, no, Skynet is just like should be a faceless computer system that, you know, and then like, but then you get Terminator Salvation and they're going to like an office of cyber, you know, there's like a chair and he's talking to an interface. So it is tough because it is, Brandon? It's like the Borg and the Borg Queen, right?
Yeah.
The Borg is more threatening. When it's just this force, right? And there's no one to sit and reason and discuss things with. And this movie doesn't go quite there. I do know in the third one, there was like a giant machine head. I don't know if it's like the head of the machines or not, but I remember that.
Yeah.
It feels like they changed the rules that they established in the first one, right?
Yeah,
and that
it kind
of
does feel that way.
That is a stumbling block. And then to make it so complicated of like, why are there ghosts, right? Like,
right.
Those guys are cool, but you could just say they were, I don't know, have another explanation for them. I'm not sure.
They're the people that are being pulled out of the Matrix, right? Like something of them left behind.
Mm.
You know, something like that. Like
it's a
person who's left.
It's
like
the
Nexus. Whoopi Goldberg sitting there on a merry-go-round, right? But no, it's like you pull the person out of the Matrix and there's like a ghost of them left behind. Right. And then you see it maybe when they come back into the Matrix or something like that. Right. Because not everybody sees ghosts. Only some people see ghosts. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So but then, yeah, like so the architect has made this thing and he invented the Matrix and they have to reboot the Matrix every 40 years. Right. But then if they reboot the Matrix, all of these programs still develop their own goals and motivations and stuff within that time period. Like it just doesn't seem very efficient for a computer to do that.
But then you have, like, the Merovingian, he says that I've faced all of your predecessors and this and that. So, like, does the programs don't get rebooted?
Okay, yeah, there's that too, okay.
Yeah, because it's just the computer is constant. It's the people that get refreshed. So that's why it's always 1999.
But there would be a different Keymaker, because the Keymaker would probably get killed every time.
That, see, the whole thing where programs are supposed to go to the source, like even Agent Smith, right? He's like, well, I knew what I was supposed to do, but I didn't. I couldn't, right? Like, you just... There should be no autonomy for programs after they're deleted. They shouldn't exist, right? Mm-hmm. The reason he still exists is because of the Neo thing, right? In my headcanon, right? That's okay. You're the only one. But when you like, all these people that the agents... Well, those are people, actually. They're not programs. What happens to the people when agents take them over?
I would guess that they probably die. I don't know.
Yeah. That's such a... I just thought about this. think the freeway chase. You just see how the agents don't care about the collateral damage, right? But I'm like, you're killing your battery source left and right. That's actually not very efficient. There are questions, Brandon. What did you think of that, though? Like, the whole... I guess they wanted to have this cool new people for Neo to fight, or whoever Morpheus to fight, right? And so they, like, how do we have ghosts? And this was their explanation? You think that's how they got to that? Or... Because they can phase through things and all that?
Like the twins?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I like the idea of the twins, because, like, are the twins just another program, though? Do you think?
Yeah, they're an older program that...
They're an older program? Okay.
So, just like those werewolves that she kills with the silver bullets are older programs, I guess.
Oh, man, that's so bonkers.
But
I like the idea of the twins.
Do they die at the end?
No, it looks like they get away to me, because they get away, and then as they come close to the camera, they phase. Yeah, yeah. Into the ghosts or
but
whatever they are.
I don't remember if they come back or not.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't remember if they're the third one or not either. But I like the twins, but it is weird. So, like, if they're an older program and these older programs aren't as good, then why are they so deadly? I don't know. Like, that's kind of one of the weird things about the twins then.
That's true. Like, when do they develop these powers? Right? Were they always this way? It seems like when they outlive their usefulness, they're supposed to go get deleted, but if they choose not to is when they stay and get the weird stuff, right? Yeah. So
something like that. But I liked it opened up a lot of interesting, like, stunt work and whatnot, like when they're fighting and they're going to shoot him, but they phase so Trinity can get away, right? And that sequence of the car when he's going to stab him, and then he phases and then gets pulled out of the car because of that, you know, like it made it interesting in that they were kind of unstoppable, but it was still a weakness that they had this ability to phase.
Yeah, like their strengths also can be used against them phasing through things. Yeah,
I agree. Which is, I think, a good thing. Like, when you go and you play Street Fighter 2, you know, like, the character has, like, an awesome attack move, but none of them are unstoppable. There's still a way to get around it. You just need a different character to do it or whatever, you know? So, like, I like that idea that it's not an unstoppable ability that's given us. There's still a weakness to it.
It would have been cool to see Neo fight them, because he doesn't really... They kind of run off after Morpheus and Trinity, but I really do like... And I think I like all the action set pieces here. I love the fight with Agent Smith, although that is one of the ones I was talking about where, like, they just, like, guys, like, you had enough cool wire work and double work. You didn't need to cut to, like, the PS2 version of Keanu Reeves. I was 100% on board till he starts going around a circle on the pole.
Yeah.
Like, guys, that is
really
so
lame.
Fake. That was fake then. It's even faker now.
Know? Okay, so I have a problem with this sequence here, and then, if I remember correctly, the one in Revolutions as well. Okay, it's that, so if Smith was this super unstoppable force in the first one, right, and Neo was only able to stop them because he was, like, he realized his potential, and he got better with every battle and whatnot, and then he just kind of, everything clicked for him, and then he was able to fight back, but even still, like, he died, okay? Smith killed him, right, in that movie. So Smith is a powerful force. And so now, 300 Smiths are not an unstoppable force. And then in the next movie, 6 million Smiths are not an unstoppable force. Like,
well, it's because he's the one, though.
But I don't know. Like,
he killed him and he was still, like, Mr. Anderson or whatever. But when he was resurrected, like, it was effortless for him to defeat Smith.
That's right. That's right. But to defeat one Smith. So here he is, and then he's capable of putting off 300 with no issues? I don't know, like, it just, it to me, it reduces Smith to being like a non-villain now. It doesn't make him seem as unstoppable as before.
Well, I've never thought of it that way. I feel like he needs all those people to even hold his own against Neo at this point, because Neo is like the chosen one, right?
But he's unstoppable. If he's got a part of Neo in him,
that's why that it's more balanced,
right? So why does he need 300 of them?
Which is cool for interpretation.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it weakens the Smith character that Neo is so easily able to just defeat 300 of them. I mean, it's not easy, right? It took nine minutes, right? A 9-minute battle sequence, right? But I mean, like, yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, I see what you mean, where it's like, who is really causing damage to who here, right? It is, it's like, there are no, I see what you mean about there's almost no stakes if, like, it's kind of a stalemate, right?
Yeah.
That kind of becomes the point, though, of the third film, I think. And we'll get there, I guess, but we shall see. But I don't know. Like, I love the personality that he had. I love the whole, I felt like for the most part, the double special effects were good. But I just felt like they could have, if you're just sitting there in the, you know, looking at the final edit there, you're like, well, let's just take out all these overly CGI shots, because you don't, there's so much other stuff going on mm-hmm. that's impressive. You don't need it. Like that. So that's a great, especially when he flies off. And then they're all just looking up at him, and one of them's like, like, Justice Tie. Like, that's cool, each other personalities. But I really like the staircase fight, you know? Like, that was fantastic with all the weapons and off the wall and all that.
Yep,
Stopping all the bullets, that's iconic stuff. And of course, the freeway fight is just fantastic. Like,
that is one of the most amazing sequences in cinema. That 15-minute freeway chase, it's hands down my favorite sequence in the entire trilogy. Okay, like, I just love it. I think it is awesome. It is nonstop action. It's amazing. It's eye-popping. Like, it's jaw-dropping. It's wonderful. Like, yeah, there's a couple of sketchy CGI sequences, but, you know, even still, the stuff that they've done is just amazing. Like, there's just so much cars blowing up and flipping, and they're just in the background. Like, they're not even the focus of the camera. It's just excess stuff in the background to add a layer to what's going on. You know, like, I just thought it was awesome.
Well, and it's not just the fact that the ghosts are coming after them. It's like they have the agents, like the normal agents from the Matrix. Yep. So they have all these other forces working together against them, and it's just insurmountable. And they even set it up really well, too. Like, Trinity was like, you told me never to go on the freeway. You said it was suicide. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, let us hope I was wrong. You know, that sets up how dangerous it is. And then the katana with Morpheus, it's great stuff. And, the key, I laughed at the key maker. He's literally like, he makes keys like for your house.
Yes.
Like, that's just funny to me.
Yes.
And then, yeah.
But, and then he has one for the motorcycle, right? Like, I don't know. I just love that. I think that's great. Like, I totally buy that.
You are
I'm
handy.
Not like, this is cheesy. I'm like, you are handy. Yeah. Like, that is awesome.
Yeah.
That is a really cool thing.
She's like, I need to learn how to hotwire. Oh, cancel that. I don't.
Yep.
So that was great. And then I'm going to talk about Neo some. I loved how, and I remember the movie theater, I was like, they can finally make a Superman movie now. The technology is there. Seeing him fly was just fantastic, especially at the end when he leaves the source, right? He's busting out the door, and he kind of thrusts his arm out like, it's the Superman pose, right? It's so cool. And just to see, like, he is flying so fast to prevent her death, like, there's just the world behind him is just blowing away with his speed, but he's like constant. Like, that was such a cool way to visualize him flying at a high speed, and all the reflections on his sunglasses and stuff. I just thought that was fantastic. And, you know, this is before all the modern Superman movies, and, you know, so there was nothing really to compare it to. So I just thought that was really exciting. And then Link even says he's doing a Superman thing, you know, flying around. So I thought they did a great job with that, and I thought they did a good job because they removed him. Like, when he went out that door, he was off in like the mountains somewhere, right? So he was gone, so that made the stakes normal for the other characters on the freeway, because he's so super powerful. And even at the end, they're like, well, Neo could wipe these guys out in a second. Like, oh, well, he has to be here. And I feel like they spent a lot of thought of, like, okay, he can solve all our problems. How do we remove him from the situation, but also make it not feel like a cheat? And I think they did a good job with that, considering how overpowered he was.
Okay, I got a couple more complaints here. Okay, so I loved the chase sequence on the freeway, okay? So Another thing that I didn't like in the film, and I thought it was just taken too far, was the Merovingian or whatever and his wife Persephone. Like, having this internal drama of, like, this computer program cheating on his computer program wife. I don't know, man. Like, this, I'm just like, we don't need this. We don't need this. Trim this down. This is just nonsense.
They did spend a long time there.
Yes.
And you do forget that at the end of the day, these are just programs. So you're like, why do I care? So that's it. Yeah. Well, I thought even the added character of, you know, who they wrote, they clearly, that makes so much sense now. They wrote the Seraph, I believe his name was. I always forget it, but they wrote that for Jet Li, right? Mm-hmm. And like, okay, he said, no, I don't know. Take the character out of the movie. He serves no purpose, right? It's a fun scene to see Neo fight him, but like extraneous stuff, right?
Yeah. He could have just gone up to the Oracle because he went up to the Oracle in the last movie.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting that she's kind of like going from place to place too. Like he goes back to her old building and she's not there. And like, I guess she's trying to stay one step ahead of who, what, why. I don't know. I thought you were programmed. I thought I got to do whatever. No, and he doesn't care. Yeah. Yeah, in this movie. Doesn't the next one though. So. Yeah, but there was enough here. Like, I guess in my memory, I was like, man, you know, they had so many cool philosophical conversations in the first one, and this one was just kind of whatever. But no, I feel like they spend enough time to slow down. Like, especially, I really like, and it's like Chris Nolan-esque editing, I think, in the climax, where like they're sitting around, they're talking about the plan they're going to have, and you're seeing it take place, and all this kind of cross-cutting. And I like what Morpheus is like, well, if I'm right, then isn't that worth living for? Isn't that worth dying for? But he also says, like, what if I'm wrong? We'll all be dead, and how is that different than any other day? I was like, oh, that's good stuff, right?
Yeah, there's some good stuff there. There's some good stuff there. But it's also weird that they lean so heavily onto the Christian allegory in this one. Like, literally every word out of anybody's mouth is like a word from the Bible, a name or a place from the Bible or whatever. Like, they go hardcore into the Christian allegory in this one, and it's odd.
It is stronger in these sequels than it was in the first one. That's true, so... Nebuchadnezzar. No, that was in the first
one. That was in the first one, yeah.
My God, Bones, what have I done?
That was the Nebuchadnezzar that blew up at the end, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
So they don't have a ship anymore. Yeah.
But wait, I mean, so what are your big stumbling blocks then for this one? Because I thought I had a lot, and honestly, rewatching it, I really enjoyed it. So, like, you're making some good points about some things that don't quite connect the dots, but on the enjoyment factor, like,
I did enjoy it a lot. I have no complaints. I enjoyed it a lot, but I struggled with my rating because, you know, I don't know, like, I'll hold it for that. Like, I'll hold my thoughts there for my final thoughts because I think we're wrapping up the conversation here.
Yeah.
Like, it's good. I think that last shot of Bane is a lame cliffhanger. Like, I don't know, because I just don't care about that character or that plot. So, I don't know, it's weird that it's like this to-be-continued ending. You know, because the first one's not like that. So it feels weird. They should have just made a longer movie, and they should have just tightened it up a bit, I think. But we'll see how I feel after watching the third one here.
I do agree. I do feel like maybe... I mean, this only takes place over the course of, what, 72 hours, they said? So it's such a condensed timeline already. Trim some stuff here. Add on the best stuff you have from the third one. Have a really great sequel. Don't try to plot it out over two films. That might be a stumbling block. But man, so Star Wars Attack of the Clones episode 2 came out in 2002. And then this came out in 2003. Anakin has dreams about his mom dying. And then Neo has dreams about Trinity dying. And then in Star Wars Revenge of the Sith episode 3, Anakin has dreams about Padme dying. I'm like, what is this in the water about these premonition dreams that, you know? But I feel like this movie did it so much better. Because we understand, like, it all ties together, his premonition. I buy that he, being in the Matrix and the One, I buy that he would have these visions. And sometimes in media res annoys me, and that's kind of what it was. It was kind of a dream. But for whatever reason, I felt like it all tied together for his premonitions about her dying. And then especially him resurrecting her. And, like, I guess we're even, right? Because it's like poetry. It rhymes. She resurrected him in the first one. He resurrected her in this one. I thought all that stuff was really solid. So,
I mean, at least he didn't resurrect her with a kiss. At least he, like, freaking reached into her chest and massaged her heart, right? So, I don't know.
That is a line that I think is bad. And I think even at the time we joked about, like, I love you too damn much. It's like, that's such a dumb line.
I don't buy it. They are just cardboard. They do not have an emotional relationship at all. It's lame. They're bad. They just don't work for me, man.
That's fine. But they work better than Anakin and Padme, though. Am I right?
Yes. But not by much.
Stay on the Star Wars track. So. Yes. So there you have it, man. Well, Brandon, I got a question for you.
Oh, do you?
I do.
Oh, do you?
Is that Agent Smith again?
I'm trying to be.
Okay. All right. So, what is our bullet time count of this film?
Okay, so I won't be able to tell you which ones they are, but I counted six.
Okay.
I actually counted six. So there's one, I would count the first, like some of them are when she fell out the window the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the two semis crashing. And that's all I remember.
So I had two from her falling out the window.
I only counted one for that, I think. Maybe I counted two. Okay. I don't know.
Well, I counted two at the beginning and then a third one at the end. Although it's technically the same shot. So, okay,
so that's fine. Three.
Okay. And then the truck collision, obviously. Yeah. And then three, four, five, six, seven. And then I counted six during the Neo Agent Smith fight. But some of that was CGI. So
there wasn't that many during the Neo one. There's a lot that were not quite. They were close, but not quite.
Okay. So it was like all, and a lot of those were all CGI, which I'm like, should I even count that? You know, because when you see a bullet time shot, you know it. Like, you know, and it sticks out from the rest. So what do you want to call it then? So we have four absolutes right now.
So I counted six absolutes is what I counted. Because there was some in the Neo battle where I'm like, no, that's not one. There was some in that battle for sure.
Okay. So six, we'll go with this. Six is good. Six is good. Okay. Which, plus the four we had last time, that brings us to 10.
Okay.
Matrix bullet time count so far. You know, I thought this would be just a very obvious, easy one to do, but it became much more complicated when stopped and analyzed what it was. Even the shots with bullets and time don't count, so that's very complicated and frustrating. But anyway.
So you didn't count the one when you stopped all the machine gun bullets this time?
No, because there was no... We decided you had to be an axis change of your shot, so
yes,
anyway.
That's right. It does, yes. But yeah, see, some of the axis changes weren't the camera moving. They were the camera panning, right? So even in the falling sequence, there was like the truck crashing, the cameras went around.
Okay.
When Trinity's falling, a couple of them are just the cameras panning as she falls. So those didn't count. So there's only six that I counted.
Fair enough.
Okay. Well, I got a question for you.
Oh.
How many red pills out of five would you take?
I would take four out of five red pills for the Matrix Reloaded. I really did enjoy this rewatching it, and I even thought about higher. I was like, that's a little, it's going too far, perhaps. But there are questions. There are some things they kind of brush over. I think a lot of this is predicated on what happens in the next film. It's one of those movies where it's like, hey, if they don't stick the landing, a lot of these things are kind of up in the air. Things you think will pay off. Mm-hmm. Things you overlook waiting for them to be explained or resolved or filled in the next film. But that's not this film's problem. So I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 red pills. I really did enjoy it. A solid follow-up to The Matrix. I am shocked that I liked it so much again.
Okay. That's good. That's good. So I rewatched The Matrix with my kids after our discussion, and I changed my 3.5. So, like, I gave it a 4 because, right, I'm like, I give a solid. But my 3.5, I would change to a solid 4 on the first one.
Okay. Okay. Good.
Okay.
Good.
So it's a solid 4. Now, this one, I would give a 3.5, but that's a weak 3.5. So I'm giving it a 3 for this one here. So like there's still a lot of good stuff that I really enjoyed. And that freeway sequence, that's like 2.5 of those 3 stars right there. Right. Cause it's just so damn good. So,
I had a good conscience. I couldn't give it a 5. And even I considered 4.5. I was like, I gotta go with 4. I gotta go with 4. Cause it's not, I liked it quite a bit. And of course you didn't like it as much. So that's kind of, we kind of did our back and forth here about this, but on the whole, we both enjoyed it. Right, we're both happy they made a sequel to The Matrix. And I guess the third one sort of messes up. But before we get there, Brandon, let me ask you, is this franchise fatigue? Do you want to see it concluded as teased at the end of the film?
Yes, I do. Because if they're leaving with a to be continued, I absolutely want to see how they're going to finish this off.
There's no other answer for this kind of film. It's literally a cliffhanger. Like, we can say, nah, I'm not interested.
Mr. Worf, fire. Yeah, screw that. I want to see that. So,
I do remember in the theater, like, when they panned up to him and then went to be concluded, I was like, ah, like it was like a groan and a yell at the same time, because it was like, man, we're going to leave it there. And then it makes me think, with the third one coming out so soon after the second one, like if it had been the normal 2 years, maybe even 3 years between movies, right? Would Reloaded kind of like had more of its own identity and be well regarded and well remembered, instead of like immediately this one comes out. So like there was no time to everyone to kind of settle in and, you know, have their opinions crystallize on Reloaded before Revolutions came in and just did what it did. You know what I mean?
This was kind of a thing at the time, though. Like, Kill Bill came out, and the movies were, what, like 5 months apart or something like that?
I think. Oh, maybe. And that was around, this could have been the same year or the next year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Kill Bill was right around this time they were doing that. And, you know, it kind of started to become a thing. They started to divide up movies and whatnot. I mean, it kept going with, like, you know, The Hobbit got divided into three parts, and, you know, the Twilight fourth book or whatever got divided into two parts, and the last Harry Potter yeah, got divided thing, yeah. into yeah. two parts. So it kind of started to become a thing and whatnot, but that's just to get more money so they could, like, you know, or with Harry Potter, because it's a long book, right? So, but I remember they were talking about dividing the fourth Harry Potter book into two movies, you know, so, like, but they didn't do it until the seventh one. So, yeah, so I think, yeah, it could have been a little bit, you know, for the, they should have had a little bit of time in between. I think that would have given people a little bit of time to process it. So, yeah. Anyways, awesome. Excellent. Right on. So, yeah, we got two non-fatigues here. We got the next one coming out next episode. We're going to have Matrix Revolutions with an S. Zach, where can people find you when you're not begging me for a kiss?
Well, you got to kiss me like you mean it, Brennan. So, kiss me like you were kissing her. You can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of That Young Superman Show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMoronZach with one S. I'm also host of Sasquatch, a Bigfoot multimedia podcast that I host here at UFP with Ken Tripp. You can find us on Twitter at SasquatchPod.
And as for me, you can find me here on the network with a show called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek, over there with my friends Chrissy and Justin. We're having a great time. We were having my kids, Aubrey and Annika, on to discuss the Star Trek Prodigy episode, so that's pretty cute and a lot of fun. It's nice to get a kid's perspective on that show. And then I've also got Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, where my friends Chris and Tom and I cover all of Hitch's films in chronological order. Thank you so much to Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson for being executive producers of the network. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for the wonderful theme music. And we have two associate producers on the network here who are associate producers of this show, I should say. That's David Willett and Casey Pettit. Thank you so much for supporting the network and this show in particular. Find us on Twitter at FranchiseFatigue. The network's at UFP Earth on Twitter, and you can email us franchisefatigue@ufp.earth. So until next time, when we cover The Matrix Revolutions, enjoy the rave.
The problem is choice.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.